Let's do. In this chapter of Kurukshetra, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, which saw publication on 15 December 1916, we're roughly halfway through. And we're seeing how Sri Aurobindo, who began writing about Heraclitus in this very issue, took up the idea of the opposition of things, the antinomy of central elements in the cosmos, that war, strife is inevitable. And we saw that Sri Aurobindo is driving us towards a recognition of the world as it is, of people as they are, of the divine as a reality that comprehends and transcends all and demands a shift in our awareness away from our small ideals of morality and what is good and what is bad and how we assess matters into something deeper and vaster and more true. So we continue with his argument here. War and destruction are not only a universal principle of our life here in its purely material aspects, but also of our mental and moral existence. It is self-evident that in the actual life of man, intellectual, social, political, moral, we can make no real step forward without a struggle, a battle between what exists and lives and what seeks to exist and live, and between all that stands behind either. A hidden dimension, unseen hands. So what occurs here is enacted elsewhere, as above, so below. We precipitate here into material form the nature of a conversation that we've had more deeply. It is impossible, at least as men and things are, to advance, to grow, to fulfill, and still to observe really and utterly that principle of harmlessness, ahimsa, which is yet placed before us as the highest and best law of conduct. We will use only soul force and never destroy by war or any even defensive employment of physical violence? Tolstoy, Gandhi. Good, though until soul force is effective, the asuric force in men and nations tramples down, breaks, slaughters, burns, pollutes, as we see it doing today. But then at its ease and unhindered. And you have perhaps caused as much destruction of life by your abstinence as others by resort to violence. Still, you have set up an ideal which may someday, and at any rate, ought to lead up to better things. Remember, Sri Aurobindo is writing during the Great War, when the whole world was inflamed. Still more terribly a couple of decades later, but this should have been lesson enough, were we heedful. But even soul force, when it is effective, destroys. Only those who have used it with eyes open know how much more terrible and destructive it is than the sword and the cannon. And only those who do not limit their view to the act and its immediate results can see how tremendous are its after effects, how much is eventually destroyed, and with that much, all the life that depended on it and fed upon it. Evil cannot perish without the destruction of much that lives by the evil. And it is no less destruction, even if we personally are saved the pain of a sensational act of violence. We'll save comments about the moral force for later when we regard the quest for liberty in India, political liberty, and this effete philosophy applied to that struggle. Moreover, every time we use soul force, we raise a great force of karma against our adversary, the after movements of which we have no power to control. Vasishtha uses soul force against the military violence of Vishwamitra, and armies of Huns and Chakas and Pallavas hurl themselves on the aggressor. This great battle between the Brahmin Vasishtha and the Kshatriya Vishwamitra continues through long discussions in the Veda and then later in the mythologies of India. The very quiescence and passivity of the spiritual man under violence and aggression awakens the tremendous forces of the world to a retributive action. And it may even be more merciful to stay in their path, though by force, those who represent evil, than to allow them to trample on until they call down on themselves a worse destruction than we would ever think of inflicting. It is not enough that our own hands should remain clean and our souls unstained for the law of strife and destruction to die out of the world. That which is its root must first disappear out of humanity. Out of humanity, so it lies within. When we extirpate that darkness from ourselves, this sort of bestial war, why say bestial? The beasts behave better than we. This type of darkness will go. Much less will mere immobility and inertia, unwilling to use or incapable of using any kind of resistance to evil, abrogate the law. Inertia, tamas, indeed, injures much more than can the rajasic principle of strife, which at least creates more than it destroys. Therefore, so far as the problem of the individual's action goes, his abstention from strife and its inevitable concomitant destruction in their more gross and physical form may help his own moral being, but it leaves the slayer of creatures unabolished. Note the connotation. For the rest, the whole of human history bears witness to the inexorable vitality and persistent prevalence of this principle in the world. It is natural that we should attempt to palliate, to lay stress on other aspects. Strife and destruction are not all. There is the saving principle of association and mutual help, as well as the force of dissociation and mutual strife. A power of love, no less than a power of egoistic self-assertion, an impulse to sacrifice ourselves for others, as well as the impulse to sacrifice others to ourselves. But when we see how these have actually worked, we shall not be tempted to gloss over or ignore the power of their opposites. Association has been worked not only for mutual help, but at the same time for defense and aggression, to strengthen us against all that attacks or resists in the struggle for life. Association itself has been a servant of war, egoism, and the self-assertion of life against life. Love itself has been constantly a power of death. Especially the love of good and the love of God, as embraced by the human ego, have been responsible for much strife, slaughter, and destruction. Self-sacrifice is great and noble, but at its highest, it is an acknowledgement of the law of life by death and becomes an offering on the altar of some power that demands a victim in order that the work desired may be done. Well, this takes us back to Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Rig Veda, the nature of sacrifice. The mother bird facing the animal of prey in defense of its young, the patriot dying for his country's freedom, the religious martyr or the martyr of an idea, these in the lower and the superior scale of animal life are highest examples of self-sacrifice, and it is evident to what they bear witness. The patriot, the religious martyr, the philosophical martyr, all part of an animal life, do say. But if we look at after results, an easy optimism becomes even less possible. See the patriot dying in order that his country may be free, and mark that country a few decades after the Lord of Karma has paid the price of the blood and the suffering that was given. You shall see it in its turn, an oppressor, an exploiter and conqueror of colonies and dependencies, devouring others that it may live and succeed aggressively in life. If one fights dragons too long, one becomes a dragon. The Christian martyrs perish in their thousands, setting soul force against empire force, that Christ may conquer, Christianity prevail. Soul force does triumph, Christianity does prevail, but not Christ. The victorious religion becomes a militant and dominant church, and a more fanatically persecuting power than the creed and the empire which it replaced. The very religions organize themselves into powers of mutual strife and battle together fiercely to live, to grow, to possess the world. I might remark that that's most especially true of theistic religions. All which seems to show that here is an element in existence, perhaps the initial element, which we do not know how to conquer, either because it cannot be conquered or because we have not looked at it with a strong and impartial gaze so as to recognize it calmly and fairly and know what it is. Clearly, he prefers the second. We must look existence in the face if our aim is to arrive at a right solution, whatever that solution may be. And to look existence in the face is to look God in the face, for the two cannot be separated, nor the responsibility for the laws of world existence be shifted away from Him who created them or from that which constituted it. Yet here too, we love to palliate and equivocate. We erect a God of love and mercy, a God of good, a God just, righteous, and virtuous, according to our own moral conceptions of justice, virtue, and righteousness. And all the rest, we say, is not He or is not His, but was made by some diabolical power, which he suffered for some reason to work out its wicked will, or by some dark Ahriman counterbalancing our gracious Ormuzd, Ahura Mazda, or was even the fault of selfish and sinful man who has spoiled what was made originally perfect by God. That, by the way, is a dualistic religion, perfect in its expression, light versus dark, equal battling equal until the end of time. As if man had created the law of death and devouring in the animal world, or that tremendous process by which nature creates indeed and preserves, but in the same step and by the same inextricable action slays and destroys. Upanishad. It is only a few religions which have had the courage to say without any reserve, like the Indian, that this enigmatic world power is one deity, one trinity, to lift up the image of the force that acts in the world in the figure not only of the beneficent Durga, but of the terrible Kali in her blood-stained dance of destruction, and to say, this too is the mother, this also know to be God, this too, if thou hast the strength, adore. And it is significant that the religion which has had this unflinching honesty and tremendous courage has succeeded in creating a profound and widespread spirituality such as no other can parallel. For truth is the foundation of real spirituality, and courage is its soul. Tasyai Satyam Ayatanam. That is Kena Upanishad, chapter 4, verse 8. Which, by the way, Sri Aurobindo translated on 15 June 1915, or at least it was issued then in print. Here's the verse in English. Of this knowledge, austerity, tapasya, and self-conquest and works are the foundation. The Vedas are all its limbs. Truth is its dwelling place. Satyam Ayatanam. All this is not to say that strife and destruction are the alpha and omega of existence, that harmony is not greater than war, love more the manifest divine than death, or that we must not move towards the replacement of physical force by soul force, of war by peace, of strife by union, of devouring by love, of egoism by universality, of death by immortal life. God is not only the destroyer, but the friend of creatures, not only the cosmic trinity, but the transcendent. The terrible Kali is also the loving and beneficent mother. The Lord of Kurukshetra is the divine comrade and charioteer, the attractor of beings, incarnate Krishna. And whithersoever he is driving, through all the strife and clash and confusion, to whatever goal or godhead he may be attracting us, it is no doubt of that, to some transcendence of all these aspects upon which we have been so firmly insisting. But where, how, with what kind of transcendence, under what conditions? This we have to discover. And to discover it, the first necessity is to see the world as it is, to observe and value rightly his action as it reveals itself at the start and now. Afterwards, the way and the goal will better reveal themselves. We must acknowledge Kurukshetra. We must submit to the law of life by death before we can find our way to the life immortal. We must open our eyes with a less appalled gaze than Arjuna's to the vision of our Lord of time and death, and cease to deny, hate, or recoil from the universal destroyer. Kala, Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 11, Shloka 32. From death to life. Asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. That ends this chapter. Man in the Battle of Life is next. Yes. We are working in the thick of it. In this thick and tangled way of works. Soul-based, we will find our way out into liberty and restore harmony here. On this theme, in Savitri, Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 10, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind, we turn to page 254, should you care to read along. Once more the world was made a wonder web, a magic's process in a magical space, an unintelligible miracle's depths whose source is lost in the ineffable. Once more we face the blank unknowable. In a crash of values, in a huge doom crack, in the sputter and scatter of her breaking work, she lost her clear, conserved, constructed world. A quantum dance remained, a sprawl of chance, in energy's stupendous tripping whirl. A ceaseless motion in the unbounded void, invented forms without a thought or aim. Necessity and cause were shapeless ghosts. Matter was an incident in being's flow, law but a clockwork habit of blind force. Ideals, ethics, systems had no base, and soon collapsed or without sanction lived. All grew a chaos, a heave and clash and strife. Ideas warring and fierce leaped upon life. A hard compression held down anarchy, and liberty was only a phantom's name. Creation and destruction waltzed and armed on the bosom of a torn and quaking earth. All reeled into a world of Kali's dance. Thus tumbled, sinking, sprawling in the void, clutching for props, a soil on which to stand, she only saw a thin atomic vast, the rare point sparse substratum universe on which floats a solid world's phenomenal face. Alone a process of events was there, and nature's plastic and protean change, and strong by death to slay or to create, the riven invisible atom's omnipotent force. One chance remained that here might be a power to liberate man from the old inadequate means and leave him sovereign of the earthly scene. For reason then might grasp the original force to drive her car upon the roads of time. All then might serve the need of the thinking race, an absolute state found orders absolute, to a standardized perfection cut all things, in society build a just, exact machine. Then science and reason, careless of the soul, could iron out a tranquil, uniform world. Aeonic seekings glut with outward truths, and a single pattern thinking force on mind, inflicting matter's logic on spirit's dreams, a reasonable animal make of man, and a symmetrical fabric of his life. This would be nature's peak on an obscure globe, the grand result of the long age's toil, Earth's evolution crowned, her mission done. So might he be if the spirit fell asleep. Man then might rest content and live in peace, master of nature, who once her bondslave worked, the world's disorder hardening into law, if life's dire heart arose not in revolt, if God within could find no greater plan. But many-visaged is the cosmic soul. A touch can alter the fixed front of fate. A sudden turn can come, a road appear. A greater mind may see a greater truth, or we may find, when all the rest has failed, hid in ourselves, the key of perfect change. Ascending from the soil, where creep our days, Earth's consciousness may marry with the sun, our mortal life ride on the spirit's wings, our finite thoughts commune with the infinite. Namaste, Jai Ma.